Welcome back to Sports Life Balance.
Stepping into ballet and seeing myself in the mirror and seeing results from the work I was putting in was so encouraging to me. And it gave me this this confidence, and it made me feel like, wow, like I am good at something. You know, though I got good grades in school, like I didn't feel that I thrived in school because I wasn't learning in a way that I needed to. And that's what the arts and that's what dance and ballet gave to me. It gave me a way into expanding and challenging my mind in a way that I needed it to. But yeah, stepping into the studio for the first time, it was like a very magical moment that just made me feel like I am and can be more than my circumstances.
That's Misty Copeland, ballet prodigy, best-selling author, and the first African-American principal dancer for the American Ballet Theater. I'm John Moffett, and thanks for joining us today on Sports Life Balance. Misty grew up poor with six brothers and sisters in the Southern California port town of San Pedro. As a teenager, her family lived in a hotel, and dancing was an escape from her troubles at home. Misty's one-in-a-million talent led her to the world-renowned American Ballet Theater in New York City, just 3 years after she stepped into her first ballet studio. But for her first decade at the ABT, Misty was the only Black dancer. This unsettling reality eventually became her lifetime calling, thanks to her mentors who showed her that there is great power in being an African-American principal ballerina. And today, Misty has become a mentor and living example for future generations of ballet dancers everywhere. Let's get going.
Okay.
Well, Misty, needless to say, I'm absolutely thrilled that you're joining me today on Sports Life Balance.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
And, you know, I know it says sports in my podcast title, but I believe that ballet dancers are some of the greatest athletes on earth. And I can't wait to dig in.
I think I agree with you. it takes, you know, so much to be an artist and an athlete in one.
Yeah. And me being a swimmer, certainly it's a less artful endeavor, but yeah. And I'm looking forward to talking a lot about the cross sections of all athletes share in their careers, because so much of your story is a universal athlete story as well mm-hmm. as a performer's story. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to start at the beginning. You grew up in San Pedro. I'm here in Southern California. I spent a lot of time in Long Beach, mm-hmm. and it's right next to Long Beach. As one of six kids, what was little Misty like?
Well, By the time we got to San Pedro, you know, I was born in Kansas City, Missouri. We moved to Southern California when I was 2 years old. My mom, by herself with four kids, she remarried two more times and had two more kids. So by the time I was seven and reached San Pedro, I felt like that was the first place I really considered home. Mm-hmm. It was where I stayed the longest. There was a lot of moving throughout the first 7 years of my life, and a lot of instability, you know, not always having a home that was ours. We were often sleeping in other people's houses or apartments. And San Pedro was where I found the Boys and Girls Club. Mm-hmm. It was where I was in elementary school and middle school and high school. So that gave me a sense of self that I hadn't possessed up until that point. But I was still extremely shy and introverted and struggling to find where I fit in the world, you know, within my own family dynamics. Being a middle child, being the fourth of six, did not help me expand my confidence and voice in any way. And my mother was so busy that, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, kind of one-on-one encouragement and nurturing. So I really found, I found this sense of like safety and security in music, in listening to music, which was often played around my household.
Right.
I feel like that was like our way of communicating were through songs and lyrics, like between my family members, you know, certain musicians or singers that we liked and songs that meant something to us. Like that was our way of expressing ourselves. And that would eventually evolve into movement, that, you know, movement was my way of expressing myself to the music. And that's how I ended up auditioning for the drill team in my middle school, which kind of sparked everything for me, but it gave me, a different purpose, mm-hmm. and a confidence that I didn't have.
Well, and that's one of the magic things about discovering your athleticism. I won't say sports because I can't categorize ballet as sports, but you do find your voice. How did you end up becoming like finding ballet specifically?
I knew nothing about ballet. I'd never heard classical music. I knew that my mom took ballet lessons when she was little, and she also took tap and jazz and all of that. And she cheered professionally for the Kansas City Chiefs football team. Mm. So there was, you know, this interesting intersection of dance and athletics in my household. We were such a big sports household, but I was familiar that, you know, she had taken ballet, but I knew nothing about it. When I auditioned for the drill team at my middle school, there was a coach of the drill team who to this day, well, she became my godmother, and to this day we are very close. Elizabeth Cantine, who saw potential in me. She made me captain of the drill team. I had no dance experience at all. And she said, I think that there's more you can be doing than dancing on this drill team. So she introduced me to a friend of hers who had a local ballet school in San Pedro, San Pedro Dance Center, it was called at the time. And she happened to be teaching a free ballet class at the Boys and Girls Club, where I was already a member and would go after school while my mother was working. And from there, you know, I was not really interested in taking this class. I was so, I felt fulfilled in a sense, being on this drill team. I was a part of a community for the first time, and I was enjoying dancing to this music that was familiar to me. It was like hip hop and R&B and pop music. So why would I go and dance to this classical music that I felt no connection to? But I was forced into taking this class. So that first class I took was actually on a basketball court. And I was in my gym clothes, and the teacher there, Cynthia Bradley, she said she knew from the moment she placed her hand on my foot, is how she tells the story, that she knew I was a prodigy, and begged me to come to her school. She offered me a full scholarship, which was the purpose of her being there at the Boys and Girls Club, was to find more diverse students to bring into her school.
And you would eventually, you mentioned Cindy Bradley, you would eventually live with her to make it easier for you to attend school and attend practice and things like that. You really became part of their family.
Yes. Yeah, it was such a unique experience for someone who comes from the experience and the background that I come from. It's not so unique, I guess, for a professional athlete, actually, or a professional performer. You know, a lot of young, talented artists and athletes go off and, you know, will live with their coaches, or they will go to, you know, schools that are art schools or whatever it is. So it's not unique to that experience, but it was for, especially for my family and the community that I came from. But Cynthia, within, I guess, a couple of months of training, she knew that I had what it took to become a professional. So she invited me to come live with her and her 3-year-old son and her husband. And I ended up living with them for 3 years. She pulled me out of public school, and I ended up doing independent studies, homeschooling, so that I could catch up on all the training I had missed, because 13, which is how old I was when I started ballet, is very late to take up, you know, such a rigorous you know, art form that takes years and years of practice so that the technique is ingrained in your body. So then you can start to evolve into an artist.
Yeah. You've mentioned community several times, and community with, it's a universal of all the athletes that I've spoken to throughout Sports Life Balance. It comes up, community, and that you can't excel. You can't create your dreams unless you have that community support.
Yeah, 100%. And that's always meant so much to me, you know, especially first within, you know, the Black community, having the support. But with that, you know, there needed to be an understanding that that this was an art form that we could all be a part of. And something that's been so amazing for me throughout my career has been the support that I've gotten from my community, that, you know, I've kind of become their ballerina, and that this kind of hope that this is what we could be, and not just so isolated and specific to ballet, but that we could be anything that exists in these places where we don't see ourselves. So community is definitely very important to me. And then, you know, also coming into the ballet culture and feeling a sense of community within the ballet world, especially at a young age that I'd never experienced before, where you find this camaraderie. And, you know, even though I've had my adversity and ups and downs as a professional at American Ballet Theatre, the community that's created within a company, it's like a team, it's like a sports team. And I don't think that people really understand the intricacies and kind of insider lens of what it is to be in a ballet company. But, you know, when you're in the court of ballet and you're one of, I don't know, I think there's maybe 45 girls in the court of ballet or something. There might be 36 on the stage, and you're all dancing in unison. And it is the most mentally challenging and physically challenging things to do, and to kind of share the same breath and experience and pain. You know, it's like being a part of a team, and it's an incredible thing that I wish every child could experience.
Yeah, me too. And I just believe wholeheartedly, the power of sports and athletics and mm-hmm. ballet, it's transformative to kids. It certainly can be transformative. I want to move on to an excerpt from your memoir, Life in Motion. And at 15 years old, you had really sort of skyrocketed into the ranks of being one of the great teenage dancers. And you were in the, I believe it was the finals of the Spotlight Awards. And you had a hard time completing all of your fouettes. Is that the way you say it?
Fouettes.
Sorry. Fouettes. And please excuse my ballet bumbles, but but
thank you for trying.
But it's a staple of ballet moves. It's the valet move that you see when you open up a jewelry box in the little ballet. Right?
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
Well, describe how you, with the help of Cindy, because you couldn't connect all those, and it's right before your rehearsal or right before your performance, how you, with the help of Cindy, changed both your routine and your mindset.
Yeah. I love that you're getting into this because it's so important. You know, the emotional and mental state that you're in is so vital to a performance. You know, the same as an athlete prepares to compete and to perform, you know, it's the same similar preparations as an artist and as a dancer. I was learning and discovering this at a young age. I'd only been dancing for, you know, under 2 years when I made it to the finals of this very important arts competition in Southern California called the Music Center Spotlight Awards. And I'd never been a part of something like this. I've never experienced nerves going on stage. And this was the first time that it was something different. It wasn't just about me performing and making the audience happy, but it was competing. And I'd never experienced something like that. And so, you know, the nerves got the best of me. And in my dress rehearsal, I could not perform the fouettés, which come at the end of the performance. It's like the big finale. And my teacher, Cynthia, took me into, you know, we tried to find a private space in this like theater where everyone was excited and people from different genres of the arts are competing and preparing. And she took me down to the garage underneath the theater, and she, you know, had a talk with me and just said that, you know, it's not what we're doing is showing all of your potential as a performer and as an artist. And it's not about these technical feats. It's about, you know, telling a story. And so she turned the music on in the car and re-choreographed the end. And this was like, I don't know, an hour or two before I competed. And she re-choreographed it, and we, you know, tried it out in the parking lot, and I was like, all right, I can do this. And went on stage a couple of hours later, and I won.
Yeah. Well, and it's such a, I love this story, and I take this excerpt because it's such a, again, a universal lesson that, let's face it, stuff happens in life. Yeah. And improvisation is vital, because you can't control the unexpected.
100%. And I learned even more of what that means, like later in my career working with Prince, you know, the power of being able to, you know, be on your toes and be able to improvise and adjust to what happens in live theater, those elements that are out of your control. And I learned to enjoy it. Like, that's one of my favorite parts of performing, is like, what's going to happen, and I'm up for the challenge of what that recovery will look like if there is a mistake or whatever it may be.
Well, needless to say, because of the Spotlight Awards and other things that you were able to accomplish, your performances were really getting the attention of not only throughout LA, but also the world. And it was opening up for you. Describe what that felt like when you were, I remember a passage in your book that you looked into a mirror and you realized, wow, I'm good. I have potential. And that's a magic moment in the development of a young adult or child.
Yeah. It was just so fascinating, because I was always very comfortable in my skin in terms of, like, you know, being biracial, being a mixed woman, being a Black woman, you know, whereas there are a lot of young people, especially, that struggle in terms of that identity. I was always very clear that, you know, I'm a Black woman, this is how the world is going to receive me. But I was still so uncomfortable in my skin in so many other ways. And what's so interesting is stepping into ballet and seeing myself in the mirror and seeing results from the work I was putting in, was so encouraging to me. And it gave me this, this confidence, and it made me feel like, wow, like, I am good at something. You know, though I got good grades in school, like, I didn't feel that I thrived in school, because I wasn't learning in a way that I needed to. And that's what the arts and that's what dance and ballet gave to me. It gave me a way into expanding and challenging my mind in a way that I needed it to. But yeah, stepping into the studio for the first time, it was like a very magical mm-hmm. moment. That just made me feel like I am and can be more than my circumstances.
Let's fast forward to New York City and the American Ballet Theater. I mean, it has to be any young ballerina's dream, and it had to have been like in your young teenage life, your ultimate goal. Tell me about when you finally made it there.
It was my dream from the moment I stepped into the ballet studio. My teacher, Cindy, was very intentional about the company, the ballet company she was exposing me to. She made sure that I knew and saw all of the dancers at American Ballet Theatre, understood their history, because she felt that as a Black girl, that was probably going to be my best shot at an elite ballet company. Though they hadn't had a lot of Black dancers and certainly hadn't had a Black woman become a principal dancer, they were the most diverse in terms of culture, whereas a lot of these elite ballet companies in London or in Russia, wherever they may be, they have a ballet school where all the students kind of are from that place. Mm. They train in that technique and then they get into the company. If you're an outsider, you're not getting into that school and you're not getting into that company. So ABT was a place that she saw I could have a potential career. So that was my dream. Literally from 13 years old, when I started dancing, ABT was my goal. So to actually get a contract, was mind blowing. I remember graduating high school and just being like, peace, I gotta go to New York. I'm not looking back. it was life changing and exciting. But, what was shocking was, I was so excited to come from a culturally diverse place, like, Southern California and San Pedro, and move to New York, where, I was like, I'm going to be surrounded by these different cultures and communities. And it was so exciting, different types of artists. And then the reality hit that I was spending, 5 to 6 days a week, 8 hours a day in the studio and in a building only surrounded by white people. And that was when it hit me, just how rare it was to be in the position I was in. That wasn't something that was often talked about when I was training. The big story was the fact that I came from, nothing. I was living in a motel and then I became this ballet prodigy. It wasn't the fact that I was a Black girl or, a Black woman. So that kind of became this new identity for me, where I was the only Black woman in American Ballet Theatre for the first decade of my career. So this kind of fantasy I had of what ABT was going to be like wasn't all that I thought it was going to be. I mean, of course, there were the incredible, being on stage with these legends that I grew up admiring, Paloma Herrera was my idol, and Angel Correa and Julie Kent and Susan Jaffe, all of these incredible artists I was sharing the stage with and getting to travel the world performing. But at the same time, I wasn't getting challenged. I wasn't being given opportunity. And, there was just a lot of, microaggressions because I was a Black woman in this white European art form that I was not anticipating and not ready for.
Describe the article in the New York Times then. I guess you were about 10 years into your ABT career, something like that. The New York Times wrote a feature article, Where Are All the Black Swans? What did that article highlight and expose for you in the place that you were at that point at ABT?
Yeah. These are conversations that have come and gone since ballet existed, I'm sure. But nothing's ever really done about it. And I mean the lack of diversity in classical ballet. So this article was a bigger deal than it had been in other, mentions or conversations around this topic. It was the first time in one place that several of the top ballet companies in America, globally, but specifically in America, were called out for not having Black dancers, for not, giving opportunities to Black dancers and acknowledging that they're out there, because that's always the first excuse is that there aren't enough to choose from. And this was, you know, something I realized. I mean, I was sitting there alone at ABT for as long as I was, but to step back and see the bigger picture of this history, you know, even to the, you know, they called out the fact that when Dance Theater of Harlem went under, which they were not in existence for 7 years, where did all those Black classically trained ballet dancers go? Nowhere.
We'll be right back with Misty in just a minute. Let me tell you about our partner, Roka. They're known for their world-class sunglasses, eyewear, and apparel. And I've been using their wetsuits and goggles and swimsuits for many years because they design and manufacture the best gear you can buy. Roka's amazing eyeglasses and sunglasses are made in Austin, Texas, and designed for those of us who like to get outside and want to look good doing it. I own a few pairs myself, and they're incredibly light, and they stay right on my face no matter how sweaty I am or what I'm doing. And the best part is, you can try them on right at home. Roka will send you your choice of 4 frames, see how they look on your face, and then pick your favorite. And if you need prescription glasses like I do, just send your prescription to Roka with your online order, and they'll customize the lenses for you. So after this episode, go to roka.com. That's roka.com. And enter discount code SLB, as in Sports Life Balance. That's just 3 letters to save 20% on all of your orders. And that's for anything on their website. Enjoy your new gear. And now let's get back to my chat with Misty Copeland.
But to step back and see the bigger picture of this history, you know, even to the, you know, they called out the fact that when Dance Theater of Harlem went under, which they were not in existence for 7 years, where did all those Black classically trained ballet dancers go? Nowhere. They had to stop dancing, become modern dancers. I mean, that this is unbelievable. So it opened my eyes and my mind to, the fact that I was a part of something so much bigger than I thought. You know, I often just looked at myself as one of, you know, one of 80, 90 dancers at American Ballet Theatre that were so fortunate to be a part of this elite company and this tradition and this history. But in reality, I was a part of this Black ballerina history that needed to continue. And so I felt like I had a bigger responsibility and purpose than I realized I had. And from there, it was just kind of like, okay, this is what my mission is and my purpose is, to be able to really dig deeper and have conversations about these things.
Did you, we talked about community earlier. Did you feel as though you had the support from your community, or maybe were you feeling like you were a bit alone in ABT?
I definitely felt isolated and alone. You know, I remember, I don't even think I truly understood the emotions I felt around reading the article. But going to work, you know, like I was explaining earlier, just the camaraderie you feel when you're a part of a ballet company. And so, you know, I expected to have that same support that I feel when I'm on the stage with these dancers, when I went to share what I was feeling about this article. I did not get the response I was anticipating and expecting. I got a lot of, was this article kind of blown out of proportion? Is this really like the reality? Is this your reality? Is this how you feel? Kind of doubting the magnitude of the issue, which was so devastating and hurtful to me. And over the years, you know, it's taken support and mentoring for me to understand how to deal in situations like that and how to have conversations with people who don't have that experience, and have it in a way that's, you know, going to actually make change and not just kind of be like a blame game. It's been another part of my training is how to navigate in a white space, as someone who's other.
I mean, I've found in my life, and I believe you, I've read that you have felt the same way, that there's oftentimes when you're feeling really down or having a difficult time, that oftentimes in life there's an antidote that comes along. And Prince, you mentioned, was kind of that antidote where he reached out to you so that you could collaborate with him. And by the way, yes, that Prince, you know, the band, you know, the prolific guitarist, songwriter, singer. Tell me about that and how that relationship developed.
Yeah. So I heard through a friend of mine that he had been trying to contact me. And what I heard, and we eventually would have these conversations, and he never would really share. He was so mysterious. The way that he came across to America, to the world, that's how he was. He was very mysterious in that way, where he wasn't always sharing every detail of things. So I never really knew what had happened when he was trying to get a hold of me. But supposedly he was trying to reach ABT, and they weren't giving me this message for over a year. He was looking for me to star in a music video of his, where he had in his mind, he had been following my career in California since I was a young girl, and had in mind that he wanted me to be the ballerina in this video. And he couldn't get a hold of me. So he hired another ballerina, made the video, and then said, this isn't right. I still need to find Misty. So a year later, he ended up getting in touch with me. And within a couple of days, I was in Los Angeles, improvising on the set of his video, literally just making up steps to the music. And that was the beginning of our working relationship and friendship, where he really gave me an opportunity, is how I saw it. You know, I by no means was trying to become Prince's dancer. You know, I was very much in the midst of my career at American Ballet Theatre. I was a soloist at the time, you know, striving to be a principal dancer. And, you know, what I saw was an opportunity to reach more people, to introduce ballet possibly to an audience who might not feel it's something that they're interested in, might not feel welcome in that space, whatever it may be. And so we had a great understanding that, you know, that we were benefiting from each other. And he really challenged me as an artist to be comfortable and confident in being unique, which is something that I didn't always see, you know, being Black in ballet as a power. You know, it's always been, you need to blend in, you need to fit in. How can we do that? And, you know, Prince would say to me, do you know how many people want to stand out and want to be unique? Oh. And I never looked at it that way. You know, he kind of just tweaked the way that I saw myself in many ways. But, you know, one of the most beautiful things of, you know, that still to this day I experience from working with him are so many people that come to me, whether it's at the stage door of the Metropolitan Opera House or running into someone on the street or at an event, and they say, I started watching ballet and became a fan of ballet and of you because I saw you perform with Prince. And it was like, that was the whole purpose of this. And he was just such a big advocate for me and the supporter.
What a powerful validation that you were on the right track.
Yeah.
I love that story. Well, somebody else who definitely served as a mentor for you, and you write about your mentor, Raven Wilkinson, in your latest book, The Wind at My Back. It's really your tribute to her and her life. How did she become such a big inspiration to you?
You know, I was at a place in my career where I was really still trying to like understand what my journey was. You know, I was a soloist at ABT And I felt kind of stuck in this position where I wasn't really being challenged in the classical works, which in order to be promoted to principal dancer, you have to dance in these classical works. Like I was doing the lead in a lot of the more contemporary, newer ballets, but never in these old traditional works. You know, you think of Swan Lake and the Nutcracker and Giselle and La Bayadere and Romeo and Juliet. And it was kind of like, how do I get over this hump? So I was watching a film called The Ballet Russe to Monte Carlo, a documentary on this historical ballet company that really brought ballet to America. One of the most important ballet companies, and watching, you know, getting inspired and learning about my history in ballet. And this woman comes onto the screen, and she's a Black woman, I don't know, in her 70s. And she's talking about her experience of dancing with this company in the 50s. And I was just taken aback because I had no idea that there was a Black woman in that company. I had no idea about this woman's history. And it made me so angry that that's not a history that is lent to us. You know, there are so many Black dancers throughout history that you can't open a ballet history book, or you know, that didn't exist in these elite companies, or their faces aren't being put in these books. And Raven was one of them. She was a huge, you know, a big part of ballet. And so, you know, she was talking about her experience of dancing through the South in the 1950s with, you know, Jim Crow and segregation, and just wanting to get on stage and perform, and having her life threatened by the KKK every time they would, you know, come into town, whether it was, you know, them literally bombarding their bus on the way to the theater and looking for Raven, or coming into the theater and stepping on the stage and trying to find her. And all the while, she's still going on stage and getting her mind right and her emotional state right and performing. It was extremely inspiring to learn of her story. And then I was on a mission to find her, you know, figure out, was she alive? Where did she live? You know, what was going on with her? And my manager, Gilda Squire, went to work and found out that Raven lived a block away from me. Oh, no on way. The west side. And it was just like, this is meant to be. This is incredible. And the very first time we met was at a conversation that was held between two generations of Black ballerinas. So it was with Raven and myself at the Studio Museum in Harlem. And we met moments before we stepped onto the stage to have this conversation. And it was extremely emotional.
Well, the importance of having a mentor and is that they face similar things that you're facing and can help you with your path, because their path they took was similar to yours.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Raven gave me was an understanding of the strength and the responsibility, all of that it takes to be in that position. That kind of opened up my mind and expanded it to understanding my purpose in a different way, or what I felt my purpose is and was. And that was to be, I mean, I'm already a storyteller through my art and through dance, but to be a storyteller in a way of telling the stories of Black and Brown people who aren't acknowledged, their contributions to the art form aren't documented. And so Raven gave me that spark to start to do that. And she just, you know, always carried herself with so much pride and grace and humility. And I mean that in the best way, not humble, like she wasn't worthy, like she was so strong and confident, but didn't need to, you know, shout it from the rooftops. She held herself in a way that, like, you just knew that, she was incredible. And even the way that she handled, you know, talking about her experiences, she always had empathy and compassion for, you know, people that wanted her annihilated. You know, she even talked about the compassion she had and the humanity that she could see in the KKK, which, you know, was incredible. But she showed me so much more. Like, I was experiencing racism and being alone in this art form. But if she could do what she did in that time, then I definitely can wake up every morning and be a beacon for so many that want to follow my path and the path of so many of us who have laid the foundation. I mean, she made my life make much more sense.
You mentioned a beacon and being a beacon, and one of those moments in your life journey that was, in fact, that beacon was the Firebird. Explain to our listeners why that role, getting that role, was so important, not just in your career, but for the career of others and the message that you wanted to tell in your story.
Yeah. I'm sure a lot of athletes can relate to this. But when I think I was 29 years old, you know, which is, it's getting up there for an athlete in terms of age, and I was still not at the top of my field. And, you know, I always had hope, even though things didn't always look promising. I always thought, you know, I've never followed a conventional path. I started late. There were all these things that, you know, could have worked against me, and I've used them as power. So I never saw the opportunities as impossible. So I was always striving, but even at 29, and I had never performed the leading principal role in a classical work, I still had faith that it would come. So when the choreographer, Alexei Ratmansky, you know, was someone that would come into a rehearsal studio and look at the potential of people, not the way that these companies typically work, where you've been in the company, they think they know what you're capable of, and so they cast the same people over and over again, or you're stuck in a box and they're never going to give you this opportunity. So when Alexei came and he thought, oh, I can see her as the Firebird, he gave me the opportunity. And I was one of three ballerinas cast to perform the lead, which was a huge deal for a soloist, a huge deal for a Black woman. And especially for someone at 29 years old, approaching this role for the first time, and not even just physically, you know, that's a big shift. I can't even think of a sports comparison, but like, you know, it's having spent 29 years old, and then having spent however long I was in my career in this one role, and then all of a sudden having to switch overnight to having much more responsibility. It's much harder to do later in life. So there was that aspect of it, but then, you know, being a Black woman and, you know, them choosing me to be the face of the season that summer, and putting my picture as the Firebird on the front of the Metropolitan Opera House at Lincoln Center, you know, gave a different sense of belonging in that space where Black and brown people could walk by and say, oh my gosh, like, there's a Black woman. Like, is that a place I can go in and explore and see what's happening? You know, there are also just the efforts of reaching out to those communities, whether it was going to school, public schools in the mornings, and having conversations with Black and brown students and saying, this is where you belong. This is something you can do. All of that work led up to the opening at the Metropolitan Opera House of the Firebird in New York City. And it was the first time we saw an audience full of Black and brown people, young, old, every, you know, it was just, the range was incredible. And it was kind of the start of a different time, I think, in ballet, in showing that we do belong here. That there was hope for the future for so many.
And in that debut, that first night, the audience didn't know. I'm sure only your very close circle knew, but you were struggling, that you actually had developed an injury, a quite severe injury that was causing you a great deal of pain. Tell me about that, that debut and what ended up happening afterward.
Yeah. You know, just going back to what it meant to be at my age and getting this opportunity, you know, I was so eager and definitely wasn't taking care of myself in terms of recovery, rest, you know, that I needed to be doing when I was in preparation for the role and learning it and it being choreographed. And so within that time, you know, this role is a very physically demanding role. It's like a lot of jumping. And I started developing pain in my tibia and my shin. Was managing it on the side, you know, with my own physical therapist, but did not want the company doctor, the company therapist to know. I didn't want the artistic staff to know because I knew that they would pull me from the role and put someone else in and it would never come again for me. So I was really trying to manage it on my own, just at least to get to that first performance at the Met so that they could see the audience that belonged there and they could see that I could handle a role like this and carry the company on my shoulders. But I was dancing in a lot of pain. I mean, just standing was painful. That after that night, I ended up pulling out of the season, the rest of the season, going to see a doctor. And it was like a very long and hard drop back down to earth, realizing that I had 6 stress fractures in my tibia and 3 of them were almost full breaks through the bone. Which was devastating. You know, it was like, I finally get this opportunity. And what now? Like, it's kind of the end. What hope is there going to be for the next generation? Or, you know, so it was devastating. I ended up having surgery a couple of weeks later, having a plate screwed into my tibia, which is still in there today. But it did get me back on stage within a year. Definitely not the same dancer in terms of my ability for jumping and things like that. But I still got back on stage, and within I think it was within maybe 3 years, I was promoted to principal dancer.
Oh, wow! And to just quickly put that into some historical perspective, there had never been on the international stage of ballet, there had never been an African-American principal dancer. And that's since the 15th century. Yeah. That's a long history. So this is quite significant. And I just want to point that out to the listeners is how significant that was.
Yeah. Yeah. It was such an interesting time because, you know, I understood what it would mean for me to be promoted to principal dancer, especially at American Ballet Theatre, which at the time it was in their 75-year history, had never seen that happen. But, you know, what it meant for, you know, an entire community of people, you know, it was giving hope and possibilities, but it was also a lot of pressure because there was so much anticipation. Whereas a lot of young dancers who are promoted from soloist to principal kind of go under the radar. You know, they go on stage in a Sunday matinee and do their first debut or premiere. And that was happening with me. And people were asking the question, will she be the first? And it added a lot of pressure. But yeah, it was an incredible moment for me personally, but in ballet history.
Yes, indeed. I'm thrilled to just be talking to you about it. So thank you. What is your message to young Black and Brown dancers who aspire to be like Misty Copeland?
Well, I don't think that they should even think about trying to be anyone but themselves, first of all. But I understand what you mean. Striving to be the best they can be, striving for an opportunity to show that they can be a part of an art form that has often excluded them. And I would say, you know, that it's so important to, number one, know that you love it, that you have to be passionate about it, because it is hard. Just because you get to this place and maybe you have recognition or you're getting opportunities, it's even harder. Mm-hmm. So I would say first and foremost is really, understanding and coming to terms that this is something you really want to do. But also knowing that you can't do it on your own, that, you know, that the support and, you know, that circle of, you know, whatever that support looks like for you, it can be your peers, it can be friends, it can be your parents, it can be other adults in your life. But that support is so important when you're on your journey, because you just can't do it on your own. You're going to have tough days. But you need other people who also believe in you and who are going to be there to push you. And I think lastly, it's important to understand and recognize that you belong, because I think that's one of the bigger things that's like discouraging is for young Black and Brown people that feel that, why even try? Because this isn't a space I belong in. And I think that it's important for them to recognize that that they belong.
Well, I want to wrap this up on a high note. And you've had a significant change in your life. You have a new baby boy. It was born last year. How has your life changed?
It's a big change. I think that it's really made me step back and understand like where I need to really put my focus and attention, where I feel like throughout my career, I've spread myself so thin, because I know that I'm in a position that's so rare and it's not going to last forever, that I'm on stage and so I've kind of just like put myself out there, but now I'm in a place where I need to be as whole as possible to give the most I can to this little being who needs me so much, especially in this time. So, but it's changed in the most beautiful ways. It's allowed me to see that I have a sense of power and purpose that goes beyond the stage. You know, it's being able to, give back to the ballet world. It's being able to create opportunities for more growth, you know, whether it's through my foundation or through my production company, to be able to tell stories of people who aren't acknowledged and recognized. And it's just a beautiful thing to be able to be in a place where I can step back and tell other people's stories. One person that we didn't mention that I think is so vital and important to my own journey. There's so many of them, but Lauren Anderson, who is a principal dancer, was a principal dancer with the Houston Ballet, and was the first to dance Swan Lake as a Black woman in Houston, and has been such a huge part of my journey and my life. But there are so many important stories like hers that I'm so excited to be able to tell in different platforms, on different platforms and through different mediums. And so I feel like Jackson, my son, kind of opened up my eyes and expanded the possibilities of what I feel I'm capable of doing.
Well, your stories are amazing, and the biggest problem that I have was trying to select the few or that illustrate you as an athlete and your journey as an athlete, because that's what I'm passionate about, and that's why I do Sports Life Balance. And Misty, you truly represent something so much bigger than ballet, and it has been amazing chatting with you. So thank you for making the time.
Thank you so much. This has been so wonderful, and you chose great questions and topics to touch on. So thank you so much for having me.
I'll leave you with a quote from Misty's latest book, The Wind at My Back, a written tribute to her mentor, the trailblazing African-American ballerina, Raven Wilkinson. She said, "We have enough respect for ballet and love for it to hope that it opens up. Because culturally, we are all in it together in this country and have to learn to share each other's cultures and be part of it." If you'd like to find out more about Misty's brilliant life and accomplishments, visit her website at mistycopeland.com. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Misty. And if you did, please give us your 5-star review, and don't forget to tell a friend. Bye-bye.
This was Sports Life Balance with John Moffat.